This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. Okay, so this is a question that probably shouldn't have been asked, and I probably shouldn't answer, but what the hell. So I'm a small business owner, he says, and I'm not going to give his name because I don't want to get him in trouble, but I wouldn't send a question like this out, who deals with cash-only business. I haven't paid a dime in taxes in the last 7 years. Lately, he says, I've been feeling guilty about it, given the burden it has placed on my fellow industrialists. All my actions immoral. Come on. I'm jealous. I'll take not having paid tax. You know how richer I would be if I hadn't paid taxes in the last 7 years? I don't even want to think about it. You know, the bastards take 40% of my income. I work for the government half my time. I'm basically their slave, or half the time I'm their slave. I'm kind of free the rest of the time. And you're worried because you found a way to get away with this? All the power to you. If you can avoid people stealing from you, you should avoid it and not go to jail and not suffer any negative consequences. You're not placing a burden on anybody else. You're not placing a burden on me. The government's placing a burden on me. People who vote for this government are placing a burden on me. The majority of Americans are placing a burden on me. It's not you. So it's people who believe in coercive taxation, people who believe in this massive, unlimited, ridiculously sized government that are placing a burden on me. That's where the burden comes from. You know, the fact that you found a way to not engage in this taxation, it's all not to have this money stolen from you, all the power to you. I commend you for that. I just hope you're not committing any sacrifices because of that and that you're not going to find yourself in jail one day. I don't think it's worth jail time. I certainly don't think it's worth jail time. That's why I pay taxes. And I don't know how to avoid that. But don't feel guilty because of what other people are doing, because of the crimes of other people. So what is my opinion of Iran's last Shah, who was deposed in 1979 Islamic Revolution? And the questioner says, while he was a dictator, he was a secular modernizer, and Iran was much better off in terms of it was more prosperous. It was actually freer than under the existing regime. And I think that's all true. So if I had to choose, and I think if any rational person had to choose between the Shah or between the Islamic Republic of Iran, I don't think it's a question you would choose the Shah. The Shah was much, much better for the individual Iranian who was trying to pursue their own happiness, their own success, their own productive values in life. He wasn't good. So you're presented with two evils. And which one is the lesser of the two? The Shah is the lesser of the two. There's no question. There's a lot less freedom today in Iran. There's a lot less economic freedom, but at every level, there's a lot less freedom. The freedom of movement, freedom of what to wear, freedom of what to say than there was under the Shah. Again, the Shah wasn't good. He wasn't an ideal. Dictators never are. But of the two different dictatorial types, and the questioner compares the Shah as a dictator to the so-called democratically elected revolutionary government. This isn't a democratically elected government. That's just a farce. The Iranian government is ruled by a supreme leader who's there for life and by a judiciary council who is guided by Sharia, by Islamic law, and it basically rules over the legislature and rules over the president. And of course, the people who can run for president in the so-called democratically elected are chosen by the council and chosen by the supreme leader. So there's no freedom. I don't like the word democracy. There's no freedom in Iran whatsoever. So yeah, the Shah was better, but of course, what would be even better is a non-dictatorial, rights-respecting government in Iran. If I were to change one single aspect of American policy, just like that, politics, what would it be? And he gives the example of separation of state and education. He says that's what he would do. And I agree. I agree completely. If I could have one thing that I could get, I would get all the counties, the states, the local governments to sell their schools. I would get rid of public education in one fell swoop. And because if we had competition in education and we allowed that to happen, of course, this will never happen without a major philosophical revolution. So it's not like this could happen separate from the rest of the government changing as well. But imagine, just for the sake of science fiction, that you had the kind of competition, innovation, progress in a field of education, that private markets, that competition, that entrepreneurship, that the profit motive makes possible. Wow. You know, so if you had that, then you would actually be producing people who could think, kids would actually come out with knowledge, and the battle for capitalism would be easy, relatively speaking, would be easy, and we would win it. The problem is today that the government controls the schools, therefore the government control the minds of the kids, and therefore it's so hard to break through with different ideas, particularly objectivism, right? We're talking about fundamental ideas. Ideas about morality, ideas about epistemology, ideas about the role of man's mind, ideas that affect people's self-esteem. These are things, unfortunately, that many people pick up when they're very, very young and get ingrained in their minds at a very, very young age. And it's you hit a brick wall after they've gone through. The brick wall reminds me of Pink Floyd's The Wall. You know, after what do they do in the Pink Floyd The Wall? They go into the grinding. They get grinded into this machine. That's what their brains. That's what public education does to these kids' brains. So yeah, privatized education. That would be my best remedy. I don't know if that analogy to Pink Floyd worked or not, but it's appropriately. That album is appropriately dark. That real album is really about public education, and it's an appropriately dark album about what it's like to be in the horrific public education system, in this case in Britain, but it applies everywhere. All right, here's a Palestinian-Israeli question. I always get these, right? Palestinians living under Israeli control in the West Bank are denied many basic rights and are discriminated compared to Israeli settlers. Is this immoral on Israel's part? No, it's not immoral on Israel's part. The Palestinians living under Israeli control in the West Bank are a threat to Israeli security. They are committed as a political entity. They have voted for the PLO and Hamas, two entities committed to the destruction of Israel, committed to killing of Jews, committed to killing, to wiping out the Israeli state. It would be ridiculous for Israel to say, oh, well, we don't care the fact that you want to kill us. Just here, we'll protect your rights and you can do whatever you want. No, they have to be treated differently because they're committed to these evil ideas and they're acting on it. If they, you know, it's not even just a passive ideology. Of course, you can't have a passive ideology that advocates for violence. Advocating for violence is a violation of rights. So absolutely, Palestinian living under Israeli control need to be denied certain rights. Until they reject the evil ideology that is guiding them, until they reject force, until they reject coercion. When they reject force and coercion, when they reject the political entities that represent them and that are committed to force and coercion and to destruction, then Israel should treat them as full citizens. I think the solution in Israel ultimately is a one-state solution. It is to give Palestinians full individual rights under Israeli law. But that requires, and that's not going to happen for a long time, that's going to require those Palestinians to completely give up the political entities that represent them, completely give up the idea that they can achieve their goals by wiping out Israel, by wiping out the Jews who live in that land. So until that time, Israel must discriminate. It's a question of survival. This is kind of another kind of foreign policy question. How should a country respond to a jihadist attack by a group of its own citizens? For example, suppose some American jihadis kill dozens of innocents in a heavily populated U.S. shopping mall in a non-suicidal attack and are captured. Should their action be treated as a crime or an act of war? This is kind of a false dichotomy because I don't know of any kind of jihadi actions that are unrelated to the worldwide jihadi movement and therefore to worldwide advocacy groups, militant groups, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or whether it's Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Al-Qaeda, or the many, many, many other dozens of groups that are training people, teaching people, advocating for people. Look at the Boston Bombers. They went to Pakistan to be trained. Look at even the guy who shot up people at Fort Hood a few years ago in the name of Islam. He communicated extensively with one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, I think in Yemen. So this is all one entity. This is all, in a sense, one movement, one organization. And they get state support. They get state support from the Iranians, and they get basically the equivalent of state support, not really from the state itself, but through related organizations by Saudi Arabia. And the only way to eradicate this threat is to treat it as that, as a war externally, and therefore to deal with the countries that finance it, that advocate for it, that preach it, that provide the spiritual, intellectual, moral, financial, and ultimately military support for these entities. You can't win it otherwise. Now, in the case of them committing the crime in the U.S., I think it should be treated as a crime for internal justice. You know, you put them in a trial. I don't see the problem in that. We have the death penalty. You put them in front of a jury and you sentence them to life in prison or to death or whatever the appropriate sentence is. So I don't see that as the problem. But the movement as a whole, the phenomena as a whole, needs to be viewed as a war and needs to be dealt with as such. And when you deal with it as such, and I highly, highly recommend reading the book, The Winning the Unwinnable War, edited by Ilan Giono, Winning the Unwinnable War. You can get that on Amazon. You can. It's on the Kindle. It's hardback. I've got three essays in that book. I strongly recommend reading that book. And it explains why if you do the war properly, then the domestic attacks will stop as well. So one of my podcasts, I guess I stated that Muslims who are committed to Islam and certainly jihadists have rejected reason. And the Muslim world, in a sense, has rejected reason. And this explains kind of their backward, economically, cultural backward state. But he asks, haven't Jews rejected reason as well? While the Jewish community certainly values reason in pursuing wealth, when it comes to political ideology, the leftists, the self-destructive, the irrational, and therefore they rejected reason. I mean, yeah, that's true. But it's much broader than just wealth versus politics. Jewish community, generally the Western world, has rejected reason when it comes to political issues. But it's still true that science is revered among many Jews. I don't know if all Jews. Learning science, fact, reality, using one's mind is still respected. The fact that, you know, they cannot and do not apply it to politics is one instance. In that instance, they're being unreasonable, they're being irrational, and they should be condemned for that. But that's true of the entire Western world. The issue with modern Islam as practiced by, I don't know if most, but many Muslims, is they've rejected reason on principle. That is, they deny reason in every part of their life on principle. They have elevated faith to be more important than reason on principle in every aspect of life, both worldly and spiritual, both in terms of politics, but also in terms of science and everything else. So they have rejected reason as a tool, which I don't think Jews do. They get it wrong, and you could argue they get it wrong because they're evasive and therefore immoral, and that's fine. But if you asked most Jews what's more important, reason or faith, they would say reason. Most people in the West, I think, would ultimately come down on reason. The problem is they don't understand what that means, and they certainly have no way to properly execute on that or to probably function or to probably live by that principle.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.